in conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
How is my sound?
Oh, it's great. You sound...
Are you sure?
Yeah. Sounds like you're at a party.
I'm at Leon in Piccadilly.
Oh, how is it?
And there's a bit of a... Well, it's I'm downstairs. There's only one other person here, but there is some background audio. I'm wondering if it's too much.
No, background audio is good.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
You're being too kind.
Yeah. No, it sounds good. It's adding some much-needed atmosphere to the show.
Well, yeah, because our chat isn't going to really move people that much, is it?
Oh, boy. No, good point. So, had a good week? Everything under control?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. Off to the States next week, actually.
Oh, sick. So what
for? I've been planning that. For a little jaunt. No particular reason.
Oh, holiday.
See some friends, see some family. Yeah.
Oh, man, that sounds so great.
Yeah.
I love that.
How about you?
I feel bad already. Like, it's such a muso thing to do. Like, if anyone goes anywhere, you assume they have to have a reason. You couldn't possibly just enjoy yourself.
No, can't afford a holiday.
No. No, you're obviously cheating some way. Yeah, everything's under control.
How was the dentist last week?
Oh, man, it was so good. This guy loves me. He actually used the phrase, he calls me Robert. Because you're
all very formal.
Yeah, exactly. He was like, Robert, whatever you're doing, just keep on doing it. I was like,
nice.
Yeah, that's the highest praise I think I could, expect from my dentist. And I'm just kind of scared.
Does he call you by your middle name as well?
No.
Is it Louis?
Louis, that's right.
Louis.
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 Yeah. Sometimes I misspell it Louise, which is very troubling.
Easily done.
Yeah, exactly. Easy mistake to make.
Roberta.
Yeah. Roberta Louise Cope. That sounds kind of beautiful. So let's do... Sorry, that's pretty dark. Anyway, let's do some jazz news.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, why not, indeed. So I'm just going to look. This news comes courtesy of London Jazz News Wednesday Breakfast headlines. They have a very handy like email list thing that you can sign up to. And then if you want to know, like their news is incredible because it is really, really, really thorough and all-encompassing. So I just like to cherry-pick a few things from their list. Such as Sarah Coleman has a new album. I think we might have talked about that already, what we're made of. That's just appeared into our lives. But she's a beautiful songwriter that's well worth listening to. Whoops, just clicked on some kind of random pop-up. Never mind about that.
Ignore that.
Yep, ignore.
So to save people some time, they could, rather than listening to this podcast, just go to that website.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's true. London Jazz News. London Jazz News have their own set of podcasts.
They don't even have to listen to the jazz podcast, do they? Oh, well, then why are they listening to this? They don't need to. They should just go straight to the source.
Straight to the source. Turn this show off. This absolute garbage. What else is going on? Wendy Kirkland, guest of the show several months ago. She's on a tour of her Piano Divas project around the UK at the moment. So that would be cool if she's playing near you, to go forth and watch. That's all the... Oh, man, there's so much. They've also got a gig listing for everything in London, which is just frankly overwhelming. There's so much.
Is it like the little leaflets they used to do? Back in the day, the jazz in London leaflets.
Yeah, I guess.
They used to publish it, didn't they?
What, and you'd just find them around town?
Yeah, at all the venues, they'd have little... Oh, what was it called?
Well,
what it was called.
That doesn't happen anymore.
Might even be this thing. No, not anymore.
No, well,
sadly.
This is what it is now. So what is it, the 11th? There's Giorgia Mancio's Pizza Express, Joanna Eden, Elgar Rooms. It's like being in New York when I look at it like this. Alex Garnett and Freddie Gavita are at Folkestone Jazz Club. Nigel Price is playing in Highgate. My goodness. There's so much. Yeah, cool. We live in London and loads of stuff's happening. Oh, there's a guy called Matt Anderson playing tomorrow night, Queen Elizabeth Hall Foyer.
Okay.
If anyone's, you know, I don't want to... Matt's got a lot of cool work, a lot of great teaching, all loads of stuff that I want. So,
a lot of people do have a lot of stuff you want because you kind of lack in a few areas, don't you, Rob?
Yeah, that's true. He's my
that
nemesis.
Was harsh. I'm sorry. That was too harsh.
My nemesis list is growing longer by the minute.
It's growing long. Who else is on it now?
Josh Arcaleo. He's always been at the top.
Obviously. I think, of course.
Alex Hitchcock. Could really do without him. And Matt Anderson, Deeply Inconvenient. These people are incredible saxophone players of the very highest caliber. So if they could all leave London at once, that would be ideal. I've told you about the Summer of Rob, haven't I?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Tell us more, though.
Tell us more. The year was 2012, Dan, and I just graduated. And there was a three-month period where, like the guys I graduated with, Nadeem Tamori, James Gardner-Bateman, Josh Arcaleo, Joe Wright, everyone seemed to move home for a while. And there was about 3 months where I did, like, three or four gigs. It was incredible.
Whoa.
My head was spinning.
Wow.
And then they all came back to London and it was over.
Bastards.
I know. So on that rather joyful note, let's play Aunt Law's show.
Cool, let's hear it.
To the Jazz Podcast.
Hey man,
how you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. It's weird to hear your voice in the flesh rather than on the out of the iPhone speakers.
I feel weird doing it.
Yeah.
I press record and I become this horrible noise. I've got a cold as well, which is making it worse.
Oh great, that's always good.
Do you know David Mitchell, the comedian?
Yeah,
did the show Peep Show. I always worry that my voice sounds just like his, and then with a blocked nose, it makes things 10 times worse.
Yeah, I have to say, I do think it. I can see what you're saying. I do think it does a tiny bit, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
I see.
He's a legend.
That's true. That's you're right. That can get one of two.
You've got a lot of wit to live up to.
That's a bad thing. Yeah, you're right. That man is incredibly funny. Tell me about Sunbury on Thames. What do you make of the Jazz Podcast HQ?
Yeah, yeah.
As a place.
Oh,
bad train service, obviously.
Yeah, well,
pretty slow.
I have to say I don't always mind that so much though these days. I used to try and do everything really quickly all the time and hate the sort of, you know, any journey where I had to sit still for more than like 3 minutes.
Yeah.
But I quite enjoyed the journey out this morning.
Oh, nice.
Daydreaming out the window. And
the thing that does it for me about Southwest trains is that you get reception all the way. I find that really useful. That's my prerequisite for.
Yeah.
And obviously, I'm too old to like connect my phone to the tube Wi-Fi or whatever. I'm sure there's a way you can do that.
But. Yeah, but then they keep changing it, you know, and then when you're in perfectly good 3G coverage, then it tries to connect and slows it down while you're in the middle of something. Yeah, you know, there's some really important that. Social media that, yeah. stuff, which we'll probably talk about a bit.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. So look, we'll talk about your album, Life I Know. We'll come back to it.
Cool.
The first track, I should not even guess, Aquilinus.
Aquilinus, yeah.
Aquilinus.
Yeah.
Had to not get that right. We just listened to that. Is that available? Can you listen to when this album that I'm holding?
Yeah. This actually, I think, if the listeners are listening before November the 9th, then this is like top secret VIP minutes worth of music.
Major reveal.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Reveal, yeah.
Okay, brilliant.
So yeah, hope everyone's digging it.
Okay, fantastic. So before we go into the album, let's do the backstory, because it's really interesting that you were born in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Telling you your own backstory.
Yeah, 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 that's good. Let me see, yeah. Carry on, let's see.
But where. It's not a place that I would naturally assume has a great culture of improvised music and jazz. Yeah,
you'd definitely be right.
So to have grown, and you lived there till you were 16.
Yeah.
So how do you end up where you are now from that?
Yeah, yeah, it's quite weird, I guess. I think one thing that was really cool about growing up there was there were kids from all over the Middle East and the world. So that was fun, you know, and we did lots of sport, together all the time. And yeah, I did a bunch of music playing. Also it may have been that there weren't pubs and things like that to go to. I mean, I was only young, you know, it's just, I guess, talking pre 16 years old,
yeah.
But I think in the UK, it's pretty normal to go and kind of get hammered at the weekends, like before that age, right?
Yeah.
Would you go and
all the drinking I did? My mum will really appreciate this because I know she'll listen to it. All the drinking I did before I was aged 18. Oh, that's embarrassing. Forgot to the old silence mode. Was with my mum.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
Like dry white wine, sitting at home, watching Michael Brecker videos.
David, man.
David Sample.
Sounds great, actually. Can we do that when we're done?
Yeah,
with this?
No, it was amazing. That was my That was my jazz and alcohol education once. You know, was that, yeah. So
that's like the best parenting I've ever heard of, I think.
Brilliant. My mum's philosophy was that if she made it readily accessible, you could just drink at home. The intrigue to like go out on like pub crawls would be significantly lessened.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah. Because by making it not like clandestine.
But in Saudi Arabia, is it legal to drink?
No, not really. So some people do. People kind of brew their own. Where I was born was Jeddah, the city of Jeddah, and people used to make Jeddah gin. Which,
oh wow! What would happen if you were caught with that?
I think if you're Western, you're generally all right.
Okay.
But it's sort of like Islamic law kind of applies if you are a Muslim there. So,
right.
Yeah, it's sort of different rules.
Is it a law? Like, because in Morocco,
you
can buy alcohol, just nobody drinks it.
Yeah, like the cultural thing.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about Saudis is that there's obviously a lot of the Saudis maybe strive for kind of American lifestyle and ideals and products and things like that. So there's a bit of a friction between that and sometimes the slightly more conservative religious.
Yeah.
Not to sort of solve all of the problems of the world in this podcast. And I've already gone way beyond my pay grade here with what I've said, but just to maybe backtrack a bit, there were very few opportunities except for within the school and the school jazz band. So I remember I played drums in the school jazz band. I was really rubbish, obviously.
Yeah.
But I don't know, maybe something about being somewhere that was a bit quieter where we had less access to alcohol and stuff like that meant that we had to find other ways of having fun. So I used to come back from school every day and watch this Stevie Ray Vaughan live at the El Macumbo video. And just play along. And I'm sure what I was playing was really rubbish, but I really loved it.
Yeah.
So maybe we had a little bit more time to just do music-y stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Do you ever feel
I feel like without YouTube and Spotify, the music that you found and the albums that you found at a much slower pace, and you really invested. I mean, I'm like quite old, I guess I'm old school in that, like, I'd still, and I know like Liam Noble will do this. He'll make the effort to listen to the whole album.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like never like single tracks. Like, I feel like it doesn't make sense out of context.
Yeah.
You've got to go start to finish to make any sense of what's going on. And when we were kids, like, you had to, like, I do remember my school had a library and you'd go in there and I'd see if there was any gems that you could find and you'd find something. I'd listen to it for a month obsessively.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Really soak it up. Yeah.
Exactly. You really absorbed it. And maybe that's harder. But then the trade-off is that everything's accessible all the time.
Yeah.
Which is great.
It's so strange, isn't it, to think that now if I want to listen to something, I take out my phone and think, okay, cool. So here's all the music that's ever been recorded.
Yeah.
What do I fancy listening to? It's quite overwhelming, to be honest. And yeah, I do think you're right that it's difficult to contextualize things. So sometimes, you know, it really helps, particularly with jazz when we're kind of getting into jazz, when you hear an anecdote about, like on the Money Jungle recording, where Mingus and Max Roach, I think, and Ellington hated each other.
Yeah.
Was it, little anecdotes like that?
Yeah.
Just help kind of put things in a bit more perspective.
On to anything. The like famous thing about Charlie Parker getting a cymbal thrown at his head.
Exactly.
You know? All that I think about stuff. That all the time when I listen to him.
Yeah.
How that must have changed him. And
And
maybe it didn't, or maybe it did. Like, I don't want to open that particular can of worms, but like what you say about like having stories to hang on to, that certainly helps.
Yeah. Like I found this album I've been listening to last week by Oscar Peterson called Exclusively for My Friends.
Right.
And he does I'm in the Mood for Love, and he does this crazy reharm that sounds nothing like Oscar. That I know. Like if I played it to you, you'd be like, oh, what is this, Meldow maybe or something you might think. But then it was done in a sort of small home studio to just an audience of friends or something. You'd be like, okay. Mm-hmm. So maybe he was pulling things back. A lot of the time he was performing on, you know, massive stages or whatever. And then in this slightly more intimate environment, he stretched out
a bit. So interesting.
Yeah.
I've never got any like scientific facts to prove that, but I have always had that feeling that there's a few tracks I remember as well, you know, where he's improvising and you think the harmony, he's really underrated. He's really like an incredibly intelligent.
Yeah.
He's just choosing not necessarily to play, or maybe he's not. You know, some of the solos I've heard of Oscar where you're like, he sounds like he's doing like 1% of his capability, either physically or like with the harmony. But yeah, it's really interesting that like he maybe could play an awful lot more like Bill Evans if he wanted to.
Yeah, yeah. You know? That's definitely one of the fascinating things about jazz for me is like just looking backwards, you find so many surprising things continually. Like it's just such a rich style.
Do you have a favorite? I'll give you an example. My very favorite thing about listening backwards is to put on something like something really old, like the Glenn Miller band, and listen to the five saxophones play together and sound like one saxophone. And just think like that actually, because there was lots of dance hall gigs and they were playing every night, they've blended in a way that you just can't now.
Yeah.
That kind of togetherness and that ensemble sound doesn't exist in the same way. You know, the brotherhood of knowing everyone else is playing to that degree. And it kind of, I find it really interesting to think that in some ways, like ensemble playing is not as good now. It's easy to assume that because it's the present day, we're all better at everything. You know, like Chris Potter said on the one time I ever spoke to him that sometimes he just lets go of everything and listens to some Glenn Miller. Just thinks, what are we all doing awesome. Here? We should just play some Miller band tunes.
Yeah.
And I was like, I went away and I thought, I'm going to read more into that than you ever meant, Chris. I like his point, like, just because, like, harmonically things have changed a lot. But some things about that really old school way of playing every day and recording. And recording like having no amps for guitar and bass, you know, and just shredding your fingers.
You know,
it makes a different sound.
Yeah. Yeah, where the guitar is kind of just percussion in a lot of cases, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what nationality are your parents?
Yeah, so they're both English.
Okay.
One of my grandparents was German, so I'm a quarter German. So my mom was half German, I guess. Mm. But they, when they kind of finished uni and stuff, they travelled around to some different places and were teaching. Mm-hmm. So, they were in Iran very briefly. And,
did you go with them on these?
So I was not born yet, actually. Okay, cool. Yeah, so, and then when they settled in Saudi, I think, I'm not sure what it was like to be a teacher 25, 30 years ago, but I think if you know any teachers in the UK, you probably know they have a really hard time.
Yes.
So I don't know what things were like back in the day, but it may have been that my parents thought, oh, we can kind of travel a bit and have a bit of an easier life. If we sort of do this there or in other places. So I'm not sure what it is.
As far as I can tell, the British, like, primary school, especially, like, I'm more familiar with that model. Like, we, like, in my schools I teach in, the class teachers are asked to assess basically all the time. They're writing termly reports on their English and maths and doing assessments. And I speak, there's a few teachers who are Australian who are on work visas, who tell me that in Australia, they don't assess them at any point in primary school.
Wow.
You just get on with your life.
Wow.
You know, and it, later on, then that kind of structure and exam, like, stress comes into your life. But there's no foreign teachers here who really want to stay more than a couple of years, basically. Because, like you say, it's a really hard life.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly sounds it. Ofsted inspections, all those type of things.
Yeah. So how do you get into jazz? The guitar? How did you first even get hold of a guitar?
I think it was a friend actually at the school that I was at. A friend of my parents had this like old, you know, Spanish style kind of classical guitar. And they said like, oh yeah, here you go, have this. And then my dad knew a few chords, you know, we used to listen to The Doors and you could play some of those things with just a few chords and sort of early blues things, you know. He showed me some just real simple stuff. Somewhere down the line I remember getting a Fender Squire, which is like the beginner's electric guitar, you know. I didn't really get hugely into jazz until I had a bit of a revelation at in my kind of late teens when I was listening to Coltrane,
right,
doing and I think it was My Favorite Things. And I think just because there wasn't harmony moving around so fast that I couldn't really get a handle on the form.
Right.
You know, in My Favorite Things, it's a bit more modal, right?
Yeah.
I just found that incredibly exciting. And it was very similar to a lot of the instrumental guitar music I was checking out. So then there was that sort of leap over there.
Right.
And then I also found that there's lots of jazz going on that incorporates exciting things from other styles as well. Like I remember checking out a fair bit of Courtney Pine with the more like groove based.
I remember that. Master.
Yeah.
Phase of my life as well.
Yeah, it was cool, man.
Yeah.
It was good stuff. And then I got into, I'm checking out Russell Gunn, who's a very little known, trumpet player, from Atlanta, I think. And, he's got, lots of kind of hip hop crossover sort of jazz music that I really like. So Crunk Jazz, I think, is one of the albums or the style or something.
Oh, cool.
But, so it was via the crossover thing. And then, I mean, I certainly still wouldn't describe myself as a purist, but after going through that period, then I could listen to Joe Pass and Wes Montgomery and things and Charlie Christian and sort of appreciate it a little bit more, I think.
That's really interesting.
When you get used to the acoustic textures.
Absolutely.
You know?
Someone said to me, unfortunately, only when I was about 22, an alto player called Greg Osby. You know the class, and he was talking about Parker.
Yeah.
And he was just saying, before you go anywhere near that stuff, do Sonny Stitt first. It's much harmonically, it's much more accessible, and you can really get an understanding of what's going on. Even though Sonny Stitt was playing after Parker, if you start there and go backwards, you're going to have a much easier time.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear that information aged like 15.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when I used to listen to Parker, especially that I was at home drinking wine, listening to Dave Sanborn with my mum, Parker was like a foreign language. I didn't even know where to begin, you know?
Yeah,
I was just
like
a bit confused and terrified.
You know?
And I felt guilty because it didn't like really connect with
me. There's so much gnarly stuff in it, man.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
So that's really really.
Yeah, being able to contextualize things. Yeah. I certainly think I've found myself in my life a lot of the time, like at uni, for example, so I was doing physics at Edinburgh. I wasn't doing jazz or anything. So most people like didn't know about or like or care about jazz at all. Yeah. But I would be listening to it and obsessing over it. And I would try and play it to people and say, oh, just check this out. Can you hear? Listen to this thing.
Yeah.
The guitar player. And then the drummer does, you know, they're like, it's just happened just like that in the moment. And, you know, I'd be so excited. And they'd be like, what are you talking about? You know, and then, but I would sort of persevere in trying to share my love of it, I guess. So yeah, I've always tried to incorporate maybe some of the sort of like the warmth of those other styles of music, maybe like what we were saying about like the Courtney Pine, like the groove based things. That's something to say. Courtney Pine is the only person who's ever done that. But you know, so some of those elements shared by that. Or Indian music, or even strumming guitar.
Oh, there's some man, strumming on this. I wanted to talk to you about the strumming.
Yeah. So how do we feel?
The strumming.
Wicked,
it.
Man. Yeah.
Man. And I'm really into like the Pat Metheny. There's an album, One Quiet Night, that he recorded.
Is that the solo one?
Solo album.
Yeah.
Cute. Loads of, yeah. And there's some tracks where it's just, he's just like actually strumming.
Yeah. Like a Celtic folk session.
Yeah,
vibe.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really interesting. And when I heard it on your album, I was absolutely delighted. That you were doing it, because it's really rare in
yeah, jazzers don't strum,
yeah,
do they?
No, not
jazzers
really.
Should strum. Man, I think it's just the ultimate history of the Eagles came out on Netflix like
right.
last year. Sweet. And so I was just revisiting this thing from my childhood and just that.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know, I love folk music. And
yeah. Have you ever heard there's a Pat Metheny album, 8081.
Yeah.
First track is two folk songs. It's like 19 minutes long. And Metheny, there's only four chords in this thing, and it's strummed, and he goes round it for 10 whole minutes.
Wicked, just
and it's
strumming.
Beautiful, ridiculously diatonic. Yeah. The confidence and belief in themselves to just be like, this is the thing, man.
Yeah,
there's no need.
Have it.
Yeah,
here it is.
Yeah,
and to let your imagination sort of do the rest, maybe.
Exactly. I love that. You're right. Because it's really simple. And yet I sort of obsessively listen and always have done.
Yeah.
Even though there's a tenor solo on the top of it that is very weird and atonal that Mike Brecker kind of like does that.
Oh, wow. He goes that kind of tangential.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's nothing. I think it's really, really interesting solo. I'm sure people listen to this who know more about it than I do. But I don't know that there's any notes in there that are actually notes. It seems like a conscious effort to play an entire solo on like false fingerings and you know, Brecker had a lot of those.
I'm going to have to refresh my memory of this on the train.
It's really
back.
Interesting, but the main part of it is not the virtuosic tenor playing. It's just the strumming. It's just the beauty, the sound. But and like you say, it's so rare in jazz to hear it. And whenever I do that, I'm like really like ridiculously taken by it because it's such a great sound.
What's interesting, particularly with jazz guitar, it's a strange instrument because it kind of got added in a little bit, didn't it? The electric guitar.
Yeah.
Kind of got,
I guess you had to wait for like electricity and amps to catch up.
Yeah, of course. And,
I don't know, is that true? You know, we're talking about a Miliband. Like you just couldn't play how you would now. Back then, like you say, if you didn't play percussively, no one would hear you.
Yeah, and also if I play percussively, if I play like that now, hit as hard with an amp, on a normal volume, I would be like the loudest thing in the room by far, louder than all the horns probably. So, yeah, kind of everything changes. One thing interesting about jazz guitar, people don't always do much of what the guitar can do. You know, if you like listening to like Hendrix or the early kind of people who play electric guitar and really explore everything that can be done, a lot of jazz guitarists don't do that so much. There seem to be the branch that are really virtuosic, and then there are the branch that play kind of like pianists, really kind of pure tone. You know, I love a lot of both, but there's, people, maybe some of the straight ahead chaps, tend to sort of shed the skin, you know, that other skin, and kind of, vice versa. And the guys that may be coming from more of a rock background just never embrace that kind of pure tone thing, that pianistic tone, really clean lines without any articulation thing as much. It's funny to me how polarized it can be, but
I love that about the instrument. It's ridiculously versatile. The guitar, you know.
Yeah, it crops up everywhere, doesn't it?
Yeah. The amount you can do, like, yeah, it's just madness that, like, I don't know, it's really cool. You know? Everyone wants to play the guitar.
I don't know. I think it did have its day in the 80s, though, and I think it's now, I think it did have its day of being, cool in the...
Oh, okay. I feel like that's still about the saxophone as well. You know,
right.
Especially
I think you're right. Drums, though, music, at the moment. You know? But do you think people like if you think about, you go and watch a gig,
yeah,
and everyone takes a massive solo. What's the one that everyone loves the most? It's the drum solo.
You're right. It is. Yeah.
But is that just a volume thing, or is it the rhythm is primal?
And I also feel like it's because there's usually only like one or two. Like it's a really big deal.
Yeah.
Like if there's a drum, yeah, solo, sure. I don't know if you have a drum solo on every track. I reckon
it would wear off.
Start booing.
Yeah.
It would wear off. Yeah. Oh man. So let's...
depends on the drummer. Depends.
Yes, I like that. Yeah, it does big time. People, I don't know. I guess it depends on the gig, but some people just want to see. I guess it's so physical. You know, people like the act of you.
You're
like,
right. Yes,
thrashing away, and they
exactly.
Can...
Yeah.
But and that just comes from the fact that, like we say about like making music, like making jazz more accessible to listen to through your attitude and behavior. The drums is a more accessible instrument to watch because if people don't play it, they can physically see what you're doing.
Yeah.
Make a sound.
Man, so I've been playing with someone who plays marimba recently, and like she has to like run. I mean, it's like 2 or 3 meters long or something. I don't know. Well, it feels like maybe even longer, but she like has to run from one end to the other. You know, it's incredible. And also to get the thing is to resonate properly. She has to take a real backswing, you know, like a tennis player or something. Yeah, it's amazing. That's really hit to watch, you know, percussion, man.
Yeah, it's just brilliant, isn't it? Yeah. What a thing. So let's talk about, on your album, let's play the tune, let's play Credits.
Yeah, cool. About it. Yeah, the first single.
Yes, when is this out?
So this is now out already on Spotify,
Oh, brilliant.
So, anyone can check it out, listen to it. Please go and, you know, enjoy, get stuck in.
So Credits, that features Tim Garland as well.
Yeah, it does.
Which is really cool. What made you want to get Tim aboard?
Well, I like his playing very much.
That is fair.
And also I had that section at the end, and I thought, what does it need?
Yeah.
And I just thought, I think it needs some burning TG soprano. So I sent it to him.
When you send it to him, was he just like, this is sick? Or did you have to like coax him?
No, he was, we did everything in a professional way. So I said, you know, would you, if I can allocate some budget and so on, would you be up for coming on board? And
I'm just going to contextualize this quickly.
Yeah, sure.
So Tim Garland he played in a very famous pianist's, a guy called Chick Corea's band, Chick Corea's. You know, like a big time all star, you know, you could argue like top five living jazz pianists quite easily, you know, if you wanted to. So anyway, and you play in Tim's band. So, and Tim's won a Grammy as well. That's right.
Yeah. For an album with Chick. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, so this is all pretty big time, like roping Tim Garland, you know, if I told Tim to play on my album, he'd just tell me to stop. So it's really awesome. that you played in his band, which you've done so much it's impossible to even touch on it.
No, I haven't done that much. That's been a big part of the last few years. Cool. Yeah,
that's... But you studied physics. To me, that's like amazing. I'm in awe of that. Let's quickly do the rest of the backstory, round.
Okay.
So did you enjoy physics?
No.
Okay. So then you went to America.
Yeah. So between my third and fourth year, I did a semester at Berserkly. That was amazing. Right. Because I'd go to jam sessions. There'd be like gospel drummers and stuff. Yeah. And I'd never heard anything like that. Hear people playing Wayne Shorter tunes really fast with like 10-minute solos and stuff. Yeah. It was amazing. Loads of Latin American music. I heard Conical for the first, complete life-changing, actually. Mm-hmm. And there were thousands of guitar players, thousands of musicians, and everyone was way better than me. Completely humbling, just thinking, okay, cool. Well, I've just got to try and get better. So that was great. Then finished a degree, stuck around in Edinburgh for a couple of years doing sort of commercial gigs and stuff and just trying to find my feet and be able to pay the rent.
And then what drew you down to London? Other than...
jazz.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just seeing like all of... there were loads of cool people playing a lot more often than there were in Edinburgh and things.
Yeah.
So I just thought I'd move down to seek my fortune and still definitely seeking.
Awesome. So going back to Tim, how did you end up then in Tim Garland's band?
Yeah, well, I went to Asaf for a lesson.
So Asaf Sarkis is the percussionist who...
Yeah, Asaf's a completely amazing drummer, composer. So definitely. And teacher as well.
Yeah.
And has studied a lot of Carnatic rhythm and Conical with a Mrindangam player, which is like the one drum, kind of like two tablas stuck together. You play like that, on either side of it. So I went to Asaf for a lesson. I think I was asking about non-tuplets because you can hear it in Indian music sometimes. They go into 9 per beat.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, where do I start with this? And so he gave me a bunch of exercises and I still have been too scared to practice them.
Right.
But we exchanged CDs anyway. And I think at some stage, Tim was just sort of looking around for maybe someone who was up for and could do to a certain extent some different types of things.
Right. Okay.
And Asaf said, why don't you try this guy out? So in Tim's band, he's got one tuner. Maybe he said, have you got a 12 string?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I said, yeah, yeah. He said, okay. Have you got an Ebo? This tuned in C. Can you create a drop tuning that's kind of like open C, but that you can still improvise on?
Yeah.
All these kind of tasks. Yeah. And it was like, but I had the gear and I was up for going down these various rabbit holes.
Going like quests.
Yeah, Tim was basically just demanding the most like bespoke rig for each tune individually.
Right.
Anyway, but I was sort of up for it, and so learned a huge amount, man. And I hope to continue to from Tim and also Jason Ribello is a big inspiration as well. He was in the band, so got a lot of playing time with him. And Tim and Asaf, that was really, really great.
Yeah.
So I think when it came to doing my album, I just thought, I'd quite like to, if I was going to get any guests, who would it be?
Yeah.
And I've always loved Conical from, I don't know, at least 20 years now.
Because there's a big Conical feature on the album as well.
Exactly. So I thought, let's get that. And, I don't sound that great when I'm doing that. So I've stopped doing that on gigs now. But Asaf sounds great, it's performance level. So I thought, let's get Asaf, let's get Tim, and I was delighted that they were up for it. So
it's wonderful because then also, as it should be, the album is like a reflection of you and your playing and the people you love to play with, and
exactly.
Which is really reflective in how.
That's the title as well. Yeah,
yeah.
It's just my thing.
Course.
Like the life of the people I know, the music I know.
Yeah. So also in your band.
Mm.
Ivo Neame, Mike Chillingworth, Tom Farmer, James Madron.
Yeah.
What a delightful bunch of gentlemen to be playing with.
Yeah, they're all right. Yeah, they're pretty good.
How did you decide to choose the guys that you ended up with?
It's funny.
Did you make a conscious decision, or is it really like these are just definitely the guys?
Well, I think when I moved down to London, I didn't really know that many people, but I remember having a play with Chillers and hearing how fluid he was, particularly with like motivic stuff, like, you know, with the Lenny Tristano, Warmarsh, Lee Cohen, it's sort of thing where they take an idea and move it through changes. And that really, really grabbed me from before I liked jazz, when things would be very clear and melodic.
Yeah.
We're talking about contextualizing things earlier, when there was actually melodic development and thematic stuff in solos.
Yeah.
So I found it so much more appealing than other stuff. So immediately I was like, Chillers, who's so strong at that.
Yeah. I'm like scared of him.
Yeah, there are a lot of sax players.
I would never want to play in a band with my string.
You don't want to solo after him. Yeah, yeah. I was going through some video footage the other day. We played Edge and really fast, and he just takes this long solo. And I think after it, I just look at the pianist. I'm like, you go.
Yeah.
I'm not going now. You deal with it. No, Mike's a beast, man.
Then Tom Farmer.
Yeah, Farmer, like, I think
he just makes a wonderful sound.
Yeah, a beautiful sound. And I remember seeing him playing more straight ahead and then playing with Empirical.
Yeah.
And I think maybe it might have been with Dice Factory addressing some more, slightly more complex rhythmic stuff. So I thought, okay, cool. Here's someone who's, to a certain extent, straddling some different worlds. Yeah.
I find this really interesting on a strictly personal, self-indulgent level, because I've just finished that film about Richard Turner.
Yeah.
Having spent the last couple of years listening pretty obsessively and also like interviewing Mike and interviewing Tom about it and hearing those two playing together in Roundtrip is really fun to now hear those two guys playing again together.
Yeah, yeah.
Music, because it's so different.
Yeah,
they have, like you say, they're so strong, their characters, that you know it's them.
Yeah, you most certainly do. And it takes a long time of getting to know people and getting to know yourself and learning to write for them, but also for yourself. You know, it's like you've got all these Venn diagrams, like this massive 3D Venn diagram of like everyone's actual lives and humanity. And you have to somehow make that work. You have to enter that little that little bit in the middle where it all overlaps. I think if you listen through credits, there's one time where there's that big kind of like folk sort of rock out at the end. And, I remember I suddenly noticed, I was like, you would expect the bass to be going like, dun, 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 but Tom's just going with the bow. Going these long notes, you know, really kind of like, which just kind of tilts the frame in this in this nice way. So that for me is what is classic, classic Farmer. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that about, like, I remember again, Liam Noble, we is when I was a student and we were doing a rehearsal once. And, you know, we were like, we were improvising something and he stopped us and he was like, there's several of you basically doing the same thing. And so you're not adding anything to this right now. If you all just want to mimic each other, you're just creating a black hole. Kind of, you know, it's not. And like you say, like, it reminds me of that, the idea of Tom, like just when you think like, oh, this would fit, but he's doing something completely different.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually adds so much.
Yeah, it's an awareness thing, isn't it? It's like, I think rhythm sections are probably better for it, to always be able to stand back from the music and go, here's what's going on.
Yeah.
Whereas maybe if we're on an ensemble and we're both melodic instruments, we're going to try and create some really explicit sort of dialogue, melodically maybe, instead of thinking, well, he's doing this, so why don't I just do something completely different? I don't know.
No, that's exactly what it is. And that was the fun of being taught, because Liam's a pianist. For me as a saxophone player, getting it from his perspective.
Yes. But
you're right, I was just trying to do some very explicit, like, hey, check this out, I'm doing what you're doing. Isn't that cool?
Yeah. No. but of course it can be.
Yeah.
It can be, and it is. But it's not. It's having different options, isn't it?
Yeah. All right, let's talk about James Madron.
Yeah.
It was one of the very first jazz podcast episodes.
You guys just talk about tennis a lot.
That's right. Yeah. He had a lot of coffee. We talked about tennis. It was great.
Yeah. He's a legend. I think what attracted me to him and his drumming was, I think we played a tune in a jam at Ronnie's and he did a metric modulation thing and I got lost. And I was like, great.
Yeah. Brilliant.
And also his sound.
Yeah.
I really like his sound and his placement.
Yeah.
I hope none of them are going to listen to this. because I have to have the band leader role of like cracking the whip in rehearsal where I say everything you do is rubbish.
Yeah.
I am the Lord, you know. So hopefully none of them listen to this. But I can't really think of anything I don't like.
That's about hilarious. One last thing I really like about this is the length.
Okay.
41 minutes.
Nice and short.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
I like that you haven't felt, and not that you ever would, of course, but that, you know, that that's a really nice length of an album anyway. I'm really into 40 minutes.
Yeah.
You know.
It was trying to find something that fits together as a whole as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing, is it doesn't feel like there's a single moment of this that's not extremely necessary.
Cool. Oh, good.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, hopefully there's some more stretched out, dense stuff in the act itself, which is one of the long pieces.
Yeah.
Hopefully that goes a bit more, like I'm asking a bit more from the listener, you know, before the last track, which is like credits rolling in a film and more like euphoria, you know, the resolution is achieved kind
that's
of thing.
That's part of what I feel like when you say that, really, and I realize that playing tracks in isolation on a podcast completely goes against this statement, so forgive me. But obviously if I released a pod of the whole album, that would just not make any sense. But credits, you really earn that resolution if you listen to the seven tracks before
past. Particularly just the one before, which has got all this weird thematic stuff
and
in
then
it.
Exactly, it feels so much better when it's in context. It's wonderful.
That for me, you know, variety and contrast is so important. Like if you just had like diatonic strums for a whole album, that would be boring. If you just had like chromatic, dense carnage at high intensity the whole time, that would also be like unpalatable. But when you put them side by side, I think anyway, and for me, they work a lot more. They kind of feed off each other, and you're, you know, after something that's more dense and scary, you're kind of ready for more of a release.
Yeah.
And vice versa.
Yeah.
No, I don't know.
That is absolutely spot on. I totally agree. You have to reward people. My friend Jack used to call it the after dinner mint. You know, we used to play in a band, Southbound, together, where we would play like seven tunes that were not particularly listenable.
Yeah.
And then we, or like,
if you give them a mint at the end.
We'd play like Imogen Heap and it'd be super diatonic.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was like, thank you all for putting up with our music.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. So.
Do you think that ratio was correct, or do you think you should have like.
No, it wasn't correct.
Yeah. Should it have been like a sip of wine between each mouthful, kind of thing?
Yeah. No, you're right, but it was fun. We enjoyed it, but you're right. The ratio, a little heavy on the weirdness. So, how do you shop this album around and end up on Edition?
Wow.
So it's on Edition Records. But that seems to me as a bit of a dark art in the musical world, about when you create something, and like, I know it's different for each album, but where does a label step in and when, and how you end up with the one you end up with?
I think it's definitely a big question.
Did you want always to be on Edition? Did you approach them with this?
I did, yeah. I'm not sure how much I can say without sort of getting in trouble or something. So maybe...
Well, wanting to be on it and being on it, that's great. Do you send it to them and say, are you interested?
Yeah. Okay. So that generally for me, I think, I honestly don't know how it works, but I think it's a lot more fluid than most people realize.
Okay.
Like, they each label, you know, they can't put out too much stuff a year because then they can't put it out properly.
Yeah.
So there will be times when people say, no, they're booked up. Like Edition now will be booked up. I remember they've, you know, Rob Luft's got an album coming maybe in, was it in March or?
Yeah.
Or one of the months beginning with MA. Okay. Anyway, next year, March or May or something next year. So, you know, they will be booked up at that far in advance. But yeah, they will sometimes announce things with a shorter lead time. But things can fall through. Things can change. Yeah, you know, people can object to things in contracts. Yeah. Relationships can break down.
Yeah.
Whatever it is. So, you know, if I'm a person, but they said they're all booked up and now they're doing this. Yeah. You know, you have to understand it's incredibly complex.
Well, I mean, even the podcast runs like that. Sometimes I'm like, we're full for the next 3 months. And then someone else will like pop in because they just texted me. Like it happened with Tara Minton last week. Tara and I have been waiting to make a show for ages. And one had fallen through and she texted me like 10 minutes later to be like, hey, Rob, what are you up to? And like, it like a miracle, you know? Yeah. It's like, oh my God, let's do it right now.
Yes, there you,
know,
you go.
Which exactly. I know that's a really simple way to explain it.
No, that's the complexity of the whole thing, you know, and suddenly things happen.
Yeah, when you try and do it on a schedule, it's really hard.
Yeah.
If like you try and do a show every single week, which I know we don't, and that's part of the magic of doing them semi-random,
yeah,
is even then it's kind of hard.
Yeah.
To do it in an organized, sensible fashion.
Yeah, yeah.
I
yeah.
wouldn't want to be running a label. That's
yeah, sure. Oh, man.
But it is really interesting. Yeah.
I got to know Dave a little bit through doing Tim's last couple. Yeah.
Who runs the label.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's a team that they're all great there. But I got to know him a bit through doing Tim's albums and things. So right. I think, you know, how you sort of, how you represent yourself online, we were talking about social media before we started recording. But I think, because everyone expects all of the music in the world for free, basically all the time, you have to bring something to the table when you're sort of contacting like a label or anyone mm-hmm. or a promoter. You know, it might be a following, it might be you're good at social media or whatever mm-hmm. it might just be the music is so amazing.
Yeah. Hopefully, well, I did that with my album, with the space thing.
Yeah.
I went to Ubuntu.
That's a great concept. Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I was like, so the concept is that in July 2019, it will be the 50th anniversary of the moon landing.
Yeah, amazing.
And then my album will celebrate it. And that's the bit that got them. It's not like, hi guys, my name's Rob Cope. They weren't like, yes.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, it was the concept completely.
It's the story, And I think, you know, sometimes that story, it's marketing a lot, you know. It's what can we say? Because there's so many albums.
Yeah.
Coming out all the time, you know. Why is any of them interesting?
I noticed that when I try and do the research for the show, and I'm like, between episodes, sometimes we'll miss up to 10 albums, you know?
Yeah.
That you can't, there's not even time to, well, there is time to talk about them, but you'd have to make a dedicated show where we just announced every album and all. There's so much music
out there. It's quite overwhelming, isn't it? And you can get that feeling from if you are on the socials quite a lot. You know, you see all this activity and it's honestly quite scary.
It is we were talking about that before, about how like if I go on my social media now, I'll instantly be crushed by the weight of how everyone else has got a gig
and is
releasing an album like all on the same day, you know.
It's a
weird environment to exist in. You kind of need to emotionally detach a little bit from you know that I don't know, I guess as like freelance musicians we tend to all know quite a lot of people, so that magnifies the problem, you know.
We have a large social circle, and also everyone is shouting about it. If there's lots of other freelance musicians, they're doing the same thing we are, but they'll be shouting about the positive aspects, so then you know, you sort of
so can we talk about the Trio HLK for a minute?
Yeah.
Because it's really cool.
And the
fact that you're playing with Evelyn Glennie also, someone, you know, I've long, as many people are, been in awe of her.
Yeah.
And then, but I mean, how did that come about? How did you manage to like, tell us about Trio HLK quickly.
Yeah, sure. Well, so Richard Harold and Richard Cass are two chaps that live in Edinburgh.
Okay.
And they were shedding just really, really crazy rhythmic music.
Yeah.
Like really dense, just really difficult sort of forms and improvising on them and stuff. And they wanted a guitar player. And I think they checked out a bit of my music and knew I was into some level of rhythmic stuff. And then I finally actually listened to some of their music and I really liked it. So then we started to work together and we realized we needed to do an album. So we applied for some funding and got the funding, and it was thinking, how can we get a guest or something to, like we were saying a second ago about the story, how can we do something interesting, you know? Because we're just a jazz trio playing like weird rhythmic jazz. If you want to look at it in one way, but in actual fact, it's more contemporary classical music. Like Rich Harold, the pianist, he studied at the Royal Academy. He did composition,
right,
and went to Yale. So he's more coming from that than he is jazz, really. Yeah. So by having Evelyn, it sort of says it sort of plants one foot at least in that turf, the classical sort of turf.
Yeah.
Also, it's deciding on who to have as a guest, it was what instruments would work really well. Okay, yeah. We could get like sax or a horn. It's kind of obvious.
Yeah.
It was like, what could be a little bit more interesting?
So
I think we went with... We did get a sax, actually. Nice. We got Steve Lehman on the album. Everyone can check it. It's on Spotify. And
brilliant. What's the album called?
It's called Standard Time.
Okay, great. And then, so with Evelyn, I love the, like, the behind the scenes element of this, because again, it's very mysterious. Do you literally like go on her website? Because like I've done it when I emailed Chris Potter.
Yeah.
Oh, I went on his website. I found his management email and emailed him or her, you know, Louise Holland, to say, like, dear Louise, I would love to talk to Chris one day. And he just emailed me back himself, like, the next day.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that was simple.
Yeah.
You know, but then obviously there's other people like Mark Turner, another famous tenor saxophone player.
Yeah.
He doesn't seem to exist on the internet.
Really? Yeah. So it's like
there's
a ghost.
There's no website, there's no emails, there's nothing. You know?
I remember, like, Justin Brown at one point, the drummer, I know that he didn't have a phone.
Right.
Like, he didn't have any phone. But he was on tour. It's like, what if... I mean, that's amazing. I just hope
that's incredible.
I hope to do that one day.
The mind, so, how do you get in touch with Evelyn?
But with the Dame. She has a team.
Right,
she's got a team. Yeah. So I think I didn't actually contact her. One of the Riches did. Rich Howell did, I think.
Right.
He probably just used a contact form on the website.
Wow.
And then got through to one of the team, and
Then,
sort of negotiated and all that, and then and they got her on board for the album recording, and then it was like, well, you know, you've learned this music, why don't do you fancy what if we did a gig, you know, how do you feel about that, you know, just this one extra tune kind of thing. And it's been great, actually, and she's been throwing some curveballs in there. There's this one solo that I do on normally we do a guitar solo during the piece ESP, but she's become so interactive, it's become more of a vibes guitar trade, kind of of unspecific, unspecified lengths. So it's been really cool, you know, the relationship developed, and we're looking ahead to recording our second album.
Oh, wonderful.
You know, trying to work out how we're gonna surmount the seemingly insurmountable financial thing, as anyone who's
always
records, knows about. But
one more question. Do you, and this is probably an annoying question, do you have like a favorite or several favorite guitarists that you feel massively influenced by?
Oh man,
I often get skinned for not asking that question.
Oh really?
On the show, you know,
it's fundamental. It's a kind of, it's a good question, isn't it? But it's quite,
it's hard to,
it's
answer.
Quite classic.
I don't like
it's hard to yeah, I mean, I could probably, I'll probably try and
with Trish Clues ages ago. No, Laura Judd. What was it? Lauren. I'm done. Lauren Kinsella. Tried to play this game with her and she just went, wrong, I'm not answering that.
Interesting.
And I was like, yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. You don't have to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've got a few. Can I just start with the first 250?
Yeah.
And then maybe we can write a list.
Okay. I like that. Let's publish a list online.
No, honestly, someone who I go back to a lot these days is Ben Monder. Mm-hmm. I just find his whole sound world really, really interesting. And it doesn't firmly announce itself as being in any particular style.
Yeah.
And I think that leaves some people a little bit cold. That's their problem, really. But he's a huge inspiration. I mean, Kurt as well.
Yeah, Rosenwinkel.
Yeah, Kurt, Cobain. Yeah. I mean, as well, but just maybe 20 years earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, those in particular, and I mean, we'll be here all day if I carry on. But those two, I mean, Lagerlund as well, harmonically, and is getting into doing more than one thing at the same time quite explicitly, like kind of revisiting this sort of treasure chest that's been addressed within classical guitar music of just counterpoint, more than one thing at the same time on guitar. Because jazz guitars, you know, we either play chords generally.
Yeah.
If you listen right now to all the jazz guitar, there's either chords or there's melody. There's very little two melodies at the same time, unless you check out Jimmy Weibel or something like that. And Gilad Hexelman's doing a bit of that, the more polyphonic or those sorts of things. Yeah. I think guitar is actually at a relatively interesting time right now.
Yeah. I agree completely. There's a lot of like young players, you know, like Rob Luft is making some really interesting music.
Yeah, he's bringing so many cool influences
exactly.
in. Yeah.
The influences are coming from all over that. And then it's stretching my ears to be like, where are these things coming from, and wanting to check those things out. But as you say, there's just so much music. Like, I'm 30 now and I feel like I'm not going fast enough.
Oh,
I'll listen more and get, you know, like my, beyond like, beyond Michael Brecker, Chris Potter and Dave Sanborn. I feel like I haven't even scratched the surface, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's three lifetimes work.
In, that's a good point.
Isn't it? That, you know, those three men have put their entire lifetimes, you know, into it. And, yeah, it is overwhelming. I guess you just start with stuff you like and don't be afraid to be like, I just don't like this. Mm-hmm. You know, there's sometimes where I've thought everyone's talking about this certain album or certain player and I just think it's rubbish.
Yeah.
And you don't have to say that.
Yeah.
You, but you, equally, you don't have to listen to it.
Yeah. I do have a few of those.
Yeah. And it's fine. Everyone's different. You know, that's totally cool.
Yeah. Well, Ant, thank you so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast. It's been an enormous pleasure. We're going to finish with Pure Imagination. This is an absolute gem. I don't know what was going through your mind, and we probably don't have time to go into it.
I know, I just got a new pedal. Got a new reverb pedal and just cranked it up.
Oh, wow. Yeah, well, it's beautiful. I love it. It's such a beautiful tune, but to hear it done with such space as well. It's just a joy to listen to.
Oh, man, I'm glad.
So this is from the new album, Life I Know.
Yep.
When's the album launch?
So album, well, the album is released on
release,
November the 9th.
November the 9th. You heard it here first. So this is the end of the show, evidently.
Yeah, and the title of the album comes from the lyric.
Of course. You're too clever for me. I love this tune. I didn't see that coming at all. When you said it, it was like, Scandal. Oh, my God. Yeah, it was brilliant. All right. Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure, man.